Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. We're so thrilled to have Reverend Holly Jackson with us as we are talking about a hot topic right now, a really prominent topic regarding sanctuary churches. A little bit about Reverend Jackson. Reverend Jackson is currently the Associate Conference Minister for Justice and Witness Ministries in the Central Atlantic Conference in the United Church of Christ. Also, Reverend Jackson has been the pastor at the United Church of Christ of Seneca Valley in Germantown, Maryland since 2016. She earned her Master of Divinity degree in 2012 from Wesley Theological Seminary, and she also holds a Master of Social Work from Fordham University and a Bachelor's in Social Relations and Public Policy from Michigan State University. She was honored to be named as a fellow in the Resilience and Leadership Program at Chicago Theological Seminary from 2018 to 2020. With over 25 years of experience in the wider church as a lay and clergy leader within the United Church of Christ, Reverend Jackson is passionate about the impact that communities have, particularly communities of faith, can have when they work together. Based on the truth that God is still speaking and active in this world, her ministry focuses on grounding ourselves in scripture, spiritual disciplines, and community, so that we can practice loving our neighbors while doing the transformational work of justice. Reverend Jackson is married to her college sweetheart, Patrick, and has two young adult children. When not focusing on church or family, you will often find her singing, crafting, hiking, camping, reading, watching baseball, go Nats, as she proclaims one of her favorite teams, and also petting her cats and dogs or playing board games. So give a hearty Bioethics in the Margins welcome to Reverend Holly Jackson.
Thank you all. I'm glad to be with you.
Excellent, excellent. And we're so happy that you are with us today. So I know that you're clergy and you are in a particular interesting position in the United Church of Christ denomination. So before we dive into sanctuary churches and just to pick your brain about what's currently going on, I know it's an ever-evolving situation. Can you tell us a little bit about what are your ministry responsibilities within the United Church of Christ within the Central Atlantic Conference?
So the Central Atlantic Conference is a pretty big conference. We stretch from New Jersey all the way down to Richmond, Virginia, and over to the coast to Delaware and back over to Shenandoah Mountains. So we have a lot of area that we cover. And in that, I am staff support, meaning I help to resource the churches and clergy in what we call the Potomac Association, which are churches that are kind of in the DC down to Richmond area. And then the Chesapeake Association, which is really a lot of Baltimore churches and Annapolis churches. So I take care of that kind of geographical area. And then for the whole conference, my position is about justice and witness ministry. So what is the justice work that we are trying to do as a conference, and how are we helping our churches to do that justice work in their own communities? And then what is our witness, not just in our justice work, but as communities of faith, how are we speaking to the gospel? What is the good news that we are bringing to our communities? And so those are the areas that I am tasked with looking after and taking care of.
Great, great. Thank you for providing that context for us. So earlier this year, the federal government rescinded the sensitive locations policy that had discouraged ICE, which, of course, as we know, is the Immigration Enforcement Agency, from conducting raids at places like churches. In this new climate that we're in, what does it mean for a congregation to declare itself a sanctuary church? And why do you feel it's important to continue offering refuge to immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers, even now when doing so may carry, you know, greater legal risk and consequences?
Yeah, so part of the reality is that shifting landscape. I remember, and I say I remember as if it was, you know, many eons ago. It wasn't, but I remember a couple of years ago when there were various churches that were providing actual sanctuary to people, meaning as a way to not have to go into custody or not be deported. They were staying within actual churches who were taking care of them and kind of giving them literal sanctuary. Now that churches are no longer considered sensitive locations, there's a lot more that ICE could do by coming into a church. So in the same way, it's hard to be a sanctuary church in that same way. There are legal ways in which you can try to protect spaces in your church. And I am far from a lawyer, but there's a lot of movement around, can you declare that there are private spaces, because ICE is allowed into a public space, which most of our sanctuaries are public spaces, right? But is there like an office or a part of your church that you can declare is private and therefore off limits to the public, and therefore you could deny ICE to come in there? But because of the ways the landscape is shifting, and because that really limits the space in a church that might be considered off limits in a real way, sanctuary is not quite the same as it used to be in that way. However, I do still feel like it's really important for churches to say it is part of our faith that we embrace immigrants, that we are supposed to be caring for the resident aliens, as the Hebrew Bible calls it, among us, that we are supposed to be taking care of those who are in need, those who are seeking refuge, refugees. And so it is important for us to continue to declare our solidarity with those people who are in the margins like that. And so there are different ways that I think we're doing that now. But I think it is going to be more and more of a risk as these deportation kind of machineries ramp up. And there's other risks to churches that I think we didn't think about so much before. This morning in one of my clergy chats, we were talking about if the church is donating directly to say legal fees for an immigrant or a refugee, can we get blowback on that? Like, can the IRS then come after us later on? And again, I think those are shifting questions. Many years ago, it used to be, no, they're not going to, of course not. Now it's not so clear. And so there are real risks, but we are asked to take risks for our faith. And so I think for many of us, we believe those risks are worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, the recent Pope, Pope Leo, recently criticized the inhumane treatment of immigrants in the United States and called on Catholics, for example, to welcome them with compassion. And of course, you know, liberal, conservative Catholics had their responses to that. But that also recently was in the main light regarding religion and society within the news recently. So Speaking of different faith groups, there was a broad coalition of faith groups, including several Christian denominations, that recently sued the Department of Homeland Security. I believe we were one of them.
Yes.
In the United Church of Christ, and arguing that immigration raids in churches violate their First Amendment right to free exercise of religion. Do you believe providing sanctuary is an expression of faith that should be legally protected? And how do you view this tension between the government's immigration policies and a church's spiritual mandate to shelter those in need?
I mean, I think that it is part of our faith to show hospitality to the stranger and to care for the marginalized. We often declare that Jesus was a refugee, right? When in the birth stories about Jesus and Mary and Joseph, they fled for fear of persecution. And so this is who we are as a faith. And so in order to live out that faith, right, we have to do the same. Part of our faith is, Jesus says, whatever you do to the least of these, you're doing to me. And I think we have to take that seriously. What are we doing to immigrants? What are we doing to refugees? Whatever we're doing to them, we're doing to Jesus. And so for us, it really is living out our faith. And so if you're saying, well, we can't do that as a church, we're not allowed to help immigrants, we're not allowed to help pay for their legal fees, we're not allowed to shelter them if they need, or have, I know one church who's like, they use their parsonage as an apartment for a refugee family, right? If you as the government is telling us we can't do that as communities of faith, that is violating our right to live out our free exercise of religion, because that is part of what we do. It's not a partisan situation for us. This is the living out of our faith in everyday ways. And if we're ignoring the immigrants among us, if we're not taking care of the immigrants among us, then that means that we are ignoring Jesus. We are ignoring God. That is just something we cannot do as churches. And so, I think we also need to remember that we have a separation of church and state in this country for a reason. And we are not, the church should not ever be an arm of the government. And vice versa, the government shouldn't be an arm of ours as the church. We separate ourselves. So, we have to really live into that and shelter those who need it. And at the end of the day, Jesus said, love your neighbor. I saw a sign the other day that said the new question of who is your neighbor is, are they illegal? But Jesus didn't say you only have to love these neighbors. Jesus said, love your neighbor. End of story. Not your legal neighbor, not your neighbor who looks like you, not your neighbor who follows the same cultural traditions that you do or speaks the same language that you do. And we know that because he told a whole parable about it called the Good Samaritan, which had, who is your neighbor? Your neighbor is that person who you think is, the enemy, really. Samaritans were enemies of the Jews. And it wasn't even, the Jews were the bad guys in that story. Like his fellow people were the bad guys in the story he wrote that he told. The Samaritan was the good guy, which was unbelievable in that time. We lose the punch of that story because we water it down. But the question really was, who is my neighbor? That was the story he told in answer to that. And who is my neighbor is the person you least kind of think might be your neighbor. And so we have to answer that the way of our faith calls us to. And that's going to conflict right now with our government that is, quite frankly, obsessed with who has papers and who does not, and who is documented and who does not. And that's going to clash. And we have to be able to say, we are not an arm of the government. We're going to live out our faith differently.
Thank you. And I should remind listeners that Kirk is also an ordained minister. So I'm feeling a little outnumbered here by these experts. I just wanted to touch on these state laws that are now being developed to criminalize harboring. And I believe Tennessee has a law that makes it a felony to harbor people without legal status. And obviously there's a concern then among leaders in the churches that that will deter pastors potentially from carrying out faith-driven mission. So how concerned are you about these state-level crackdowns? Do you think they deter churches or sort of strengthen resolve in terms of welcoming strangers in accordance with their beliefs?
So I am really concerned about state-level crackdowns. And I will say this is part of why I personally am increasingly convinced that we need to advocate on the state and local level. We need to know what our laws are on the state and local level. I live right outside of DC, and many of the churches that I've been involved with for many, many years, we are DC area churches. And sometimes the danger in that is that we spend way too much time thinking about what happens at the federal level, which is really important. Do not get me wrong, but I feel like one of the mistakes that we've made, not just in DC, around the country, is that we've then taken our eyes off of what happens at the local level. And the local level can really impact us so much in things like this, that you could have a state law that says it's a felony to harbor somebody. And even in your locality, you could have that. And we know that there have been localities and cities that have declared themselves sanctuary localities and cities, right? And said, we're not going to cooperate with ICE. And that makes a difference. And so, you know, I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, which also is a sanctuary area. And so the local laws make a difference as to what happens locally in my area. So we really need to pay attention to that. We need to know what those local laws are, and we need to advocate locally for our neighbors that live right next to us. Because I do think they deter churches. I mean, they're obviously written to do that, right? Like that's, I mean, not just to deter churches, they're written to deter anyone, but they do deter churches. You know, one of the hardest things about churches is that we worry about risk and liability. To some extent we have to, because it could shut us down, right? But it's also a question that almost immediately shuts down all the good work we'd like to do. Are we going to be liable for this? Are we going to get in trouble because of this? Are we going to have to pay a price for this? It should strengthen our resolve to say, it doesn't matter, we're going to go and do this anyway. But in many cases, it doesn't. And, you know, I mean, I have to go back to, you know, when Jesus was arrested, all the disciples went, we don't know who you're talking about, but we're going to walk away, right? Like that it's this human, I don't want my neck to be on the chopping block. I don't want to be the one arrested. It becomes dangerous. I don't want to take that risk, you know? And in some cases it's a real risk. I know how many churches have had their pride flags or Black Lives Matters banner stolen, taken down, maybe their church vandalized. Like, it is a real risk we're asking churches and faith communities to make by declaring we are on the side of those who are most often left out of our society. And so I do think we have to go in eyes wide open. Like, we need to know, what is our danger level? Like, we can't just lie to people and say, like, go ahead and do it. It doesn't matter. It does matter. But then I think the question is on us to say, how are we going to support each other through that? You know, maybe five churches come together to do something. So it's not just the risk is on one church, or maybe denominationally we say, okay, our region is going to, you know, support this, or we have your back, church. If the IRS comes after you, we will pay for a lawyer to fight on your behalf, right? Or, you know, or church says to their clergy, if you're willing to do this, we're willing to pay your legal bills, right? We have to be aware of the risks, and then we have got to figure out what we're willing to do to live into those risks. And I think we can do that, and we must do that if we're going to begin to push back against what's happening right now in our country.
Absolutely. And I think you bring up this idea of there's probably some tension, not just between, you know, following the law, the policies, and sort of following your faith, but also there's probably tension, is there, between churches, maybe even within denominations. So can you give us an idea of when civil disobedience, if we consider that this is civil disobedience, you know, is justified for an overall moral good?
Ooh. I mean, I think that's it's a difficult line to draw, right? It is a difficult line to draw. I wish it was black and white. I wish it was like, well, clearly you're allowed to do that. You should do this and you shouldn't do this. You know, we know that not all laws are moral, and not everything that is moral is reflected in our laws. And so we have to figure out where those lines can be for us. I do think, you know, even in our individual churches, the conversation I alluded to before, where there was clergy talking about, you know, can you work within the system to do certain things? And this one pastor said, I wouldn't go that far because of there's several people in my congregation who are not comfortable with giving money to people who are undocumented. And so, you know, it puts clergy often in a very uncomfortable position of trying to thread the needle of doing what we know we've been called to do and doing what's right. But you're sitting in a congregation where there can be people who can make your life very difficult as a clergy person if you go ahead and live that out, right? So there's always this work we're doing as clergy to try to educate people, to try to get people to understand where we're coming at this from and why it matters. You know, but I mean, how many stories do we have from our history of people who broke the law but did the right thing? You know, and so and a lot of times those were people of faith who said, absolutely not. I know that God has called me to care for others and to love others, and this doesn't do that. And so I think for everyone, we have to think about that, to play with it. I think it's something, a conversation we have to continually have in our churches, which makes people uncomfortable. People a lot of times want to come to church, they want to get their spiritual top up and walk away ready for another week. And it's hard to come to church and be like, is this moral or not? If it's legal, does that mean it's moral? How are we going to live into that? How are we going to deal with that? It's not an easy conversation to have, but it's absolutely necessary. It's part of what we are called to do. And, you know, I think even in the gospel, there were plenty of times when, you know, people would say to Jesus, well, it's the law, right? Whether that was religious law or civil law. And, you know, Jesus was really about saying, okay, the law really is about, are you loving God and are you loving your neighbor? That's what we're supposed to be doing. So is the law reflective of that? Sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. And when it's not, we have to figure out how we're going to push back against it. So I think it's difficult. I think it's a dilemma that we have to continually work on. But I also think we cannot shy away from it. We can't just, as faith leaders, be like, well, my congregation is uncomfortable with this, so I'm not going to bring it up. we have to bring it up because at the end of the day, it is our calling to love our neighbor and to love God, not to follow the law as it has been given to us. Those are two different things.
No, thank you, Reverend Holly, for your reflection on that. So I know that we've seen individuals spend months or even years living inside church walls to avoid, you know, avoid deportation. One example was a man who lived in a UCC church for UCC, again, United Church of Christ church for about 3.5 years before finally receiving reprieve and stepping outside to rejoin his family. From your experience, what is the human impact of such prolonged sanctuary on the individual and their families? And how does, the UCC, United Church of Christ, support someone living in a sanctuary, not just in practical terms, you know, food and shelter, but emotionally and spiritually? And I guess I know this is a loaded question. And to add to that, have you witnessed outcomes where this act of refuge eventually led to positive legal resolutions for the person in the sanctuary?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of stories where people have lived in the churches for a prolonged period of time in order to be safe from authorities that would take them and deport them, especially deport them to back to their countries where it's not safe for them, right? Like we have to, I want to make sure that we're, you know, this is not just about, do I get to stay in the U.S. or not? This, for many people who are in these situations, the question is, if you send me back to my home country, am I at risk of death or being imprisoned or being, you know, some other thing going to happen to me because of that? And I say that because I think a lot of times we talk about this like it has no, oh, so just get deported, go home. Like that's no big deal. And oftentimes, you know, you don't live 3.5 years in a church without your family if it's just, I just don't want to go home, right? There's a reason why you're doing that. But I do think it traumatizes. I think it traumatizes everyone. I think it is... it's very difficult. And what makes me sad above all is that we don't have an immigration system that is just in any way, shape or form. We have a system that is meant to traumatize people. It is not meant to help families. It is not meant to help people who are seeking refuge. It is not meant to help asylum seekers. It is meant to shut people out and helps to re-traumatize people who are already coming from places of trauma. If you left your home because you were, you know, going to be assaulted or killed, you're already traumatized. And now, hey, why don't you come here and live here in a church for 3.5 years and not be able to be with your family? Of course, it's more trauma. So I think if the church is doing right by those people, it is offering not just here's a place to stay, lay your head, and here's some food, but how are we doing mental health? How are we doing? How are we helping you spiritually? How are we helping your family who is on the other side of that if they're not living also with you? Like how I know someone who basically had to adopt some, you know, like just be like, okay, we're your family now, right? Like how, because of their family isn't there and can't be. So we have to look at the whole person, not just, oh, we offered you a space so you can live in. It's traumatizing. And I think it's traumatizing to the community. But, have I ever seen it lead to a positive legal resolution? I believe it has in some cases, but more often than not, I think it's what are the long-term consequences, right? I think if we talk about sanctuary churches, it's like, great, that's great a church is doing this. But really what we have to work for is a time when we don't have to worry about that, right? Like that we don't have to be sanctuary. We don't have to lock somebody in or basically make the church a prison for them in a different way. And so, you know, what is sanctuary now in this age where we're not sensitive spaces anymore and people can come in. How are we helping immigrants now to find some positive legal resolution? Are we helping to accompany them to these check-ins even when they're getting grabbed up? Are we witnessing that and are we sharing about that? Are we protesting, you know, detainment centers? Are we donating to aid societies? Are we helping children of immigrants and refugees find their way through the system? Are we offering space to groups or resources? Are we calling our representatives, local and federal? That is like the new, to me, that's the new way of the sanctuary movement because of the ways that they've kind of shut that down. And the question really needs to be, how do we create it so that we don't need a sanctuary movement, that we are a nation of welcome and love?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And within this dynamic of love you were speaking, sanctuary obviously literally is a place of refuge. It should be a place of protection. I'm curious, because of course, there's always critics, right? And critics of sanctuary churches often claim that offering refuge enables lawbreakers to evade justice, right? For example, you are protecting, the language individuals use is, you know, criminals or, you know, whatever, whoever, from actually being arrested, and to make our streets, you know, safer. And folks do feel that way. In fact, when it ended the sense of locations policy, the Department of Homeland Security said criminals will no longer be able to hide in churches to avoid arrest. On the other hand, faith leaders argue that sanctuary policies actually keep communities safer by building trust and protecting vulnerable families. What has been your experience regarding these, you know, claims? And how do you respond to the narrative that you're harboring, you know, criminals? Do you see sanctuary as enhancing the safety and moral integrity of the community rather than undermining the moral integrity and safety of a community?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many levels to unpack in there, right? So to me, if you are offering either sanctuary or you're offering to help out immigrants and refugees, like, they're a part of your community. And I think we're seeing this more and more as ICE is, you know, disappearing more and more people. These people are members of our community. They're our neighbors. They're people who work in the businesses around them. Maybe we see them every day. We have no idea whether they have documentation or not. Because I think I want to use that language because we need to push back against this narrative that we have people who are illegal. There are people who maybe do acts that are not legal. But again, what is legal and what is not? Is it moral? I think we have to say there are people who are documented and then there are people who are undocumented. And we have a whole bunch of people who kind of sit in the middle that nobody wants to talk about either, right? Like if you've been granted, if you're waiting on an asylum hearing, are you legal? Are you not legal? We don't even know what that means anymore. And there are plenty of people who are legal, who have documentation, who are also being targeted and disappeared at this point. And, you know, to say nothing of the US citizens that are sometimes getting thrown into this mess as well. So, I mean, I think it is completely ridiculous to say, oh, we're harboring criminals. We may be helping out people who are undocumented. And, you know, if someone is a criminal, if someone has, you know, raped someone or killed someone, no, we do not want to be helping that person because they have done something wrong and they need to face the reality of what they have done. You know, we talk a lot in the United Church of Christ that no matter who you are or where you are on your spiritual journey, you are welcome here. And the caveat to me as a local church pastor was always, you are always welcome here. Not all behaviors are welcome here, right? And so if you are behaving in a way that is hurting other people, No, we don't want to help you. We want you to take responsibility for what you're doing and change your behavior. And if you, if you need help in order to stop doing that, we need to help you. So I think it's just this dehumanizing language that we have to push back against, and the misinformation around immigration and around the system. People don't know the truth, and they want quick little sound bites that make it easy. And the immigration system is not easy. There are no quick little sound bites that can make it easy for you to understand how people got to a certain place as they did and what is happening with them. And so we really have to watch our language around it, watch the ways that we talk about it, and watch our misinformation, and try to give out the right information. And we need to be aware, like, I know I just saw this past week that the government right now is trying to, every year we let in a certain number of refugees. We have a number that people can go up to. And usually that's somewhere between 75 and 95,000 people. And now the government is trying to say that there can only be 7,500 from 95,000 to 7,500 refugees, and that most of those refugees are slots are already spoken for because they're for white Afrikaners from South Africa. That is just the most, there's nothing moral or legal about that. Do not talk to me about criminality when that's what you're doing, when you're denying people the ability to seek asylum and to seek refugee status when they're under attack. And you're going to only allow that small number of people to be people who do not need that status. So I just think we need to speak loudly and clearly and push back around language and around, misinformation around this.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. So we kind of touched on this a little bit. You said that sometimes reverends were sort of leading congregations where there might be a little bit of pushback, and sometimes it was hard to bring anyone along or everyone along. And I know you use this idea of faith, you know, the teachings of Jesus and love to persuade people to take this, you know, social justice action. So can you share, like, there's obviously people who would always agree with this, and then there's probably people that would never. So what other strategies do you use to persuade people that this is the correct course of action and help deepen their commitment to social justice? And have you seen sort of in recent months this kind of take hold more than perhaps in previous years?
I mean, I think one of the keys to how do we talk to people about this is by telling stories. I think it is so meaningful when we stop talking about generalities that don't really impact people and talk about specific stories and say, okay, here's the specific story of this particular thing that happened. And from a faith perspective, do you think that Jesus would be like, totally fine, there's no problem with that? Like, you know, there was the raid that happened in that apartment building in Chicago. And, we have children taking out of their beds in the middle of the night, zip-tied, elderly people zip-tied, left for hours, whether they were documented or undocumented. And do we think that, you know, what are the stories around that? Tell the stories of some of that. And do we think Jesus is okay with that? How are we living into that? Tell the stories of our neighbors. Tell the stories of if we've seen people disappeared in front of us. What does that do to us as people? And really get people to understand it on a very personal level. Because I think when you do that, it starts to impact people. People think, well, that's far away. And all of a sudden you realize it's not so far away. That is my neighbor down the street. That is, you know, I have a soft spot for children, or I really care about racial justice and I'm watching who's getting picked up and who's not, right? And I know what color their skin is. I know the apartments that are being raided. They're not being raided in other areas. And yet we know that there are plenty of not just Black and brown people who are immigrants who are undocumented. We have plenty of people who are undocumented, who do not always fit that profile. So, you know, tell the stories about it, because that begins to make a difference. And I do think that we have to constantly educate people and constantly say, and come at it from many different ways. Come at it from, this is a spiritual question. Come at it from, this is even an economic question for us. So, you know, people who are like, well, we can't do this because it's, you know, we have to get rid of undocumented people so that our people have the ability to get jobs. Well, let's be honest about that. Let's talk about that. Does that really work out? How does that work out? What is the economic impact? Really be honest about this. And for our communities, I think especially for communities of faith, part of what has become and what can become dangerous is we start to see ourselves in this little silo. We go into our church, we close our doors, and it's just us in here. It's not. We are a part of a community. What is happening in the wider community around us? Our churches need to know what is happening to their neighbors. And how do we care for our neighbors if we don't know that? So we need to know their stories, and we need to know the reality of the situation on the ground. Do I think that's going to solve every problem and make everybody believe it? No. But I do think that stories make a difference. And I think when we tell the stories, it's harder for people to dismiss it. And, you know, even I think we've seen that more and more as people start to go, what is happening out there in the world? And we start to see news stories, which is why it so frustrates me when I feel like the media is not doing its job in really telling the story of what's happening, and allowing this false narrative of, you know, well, we didn't really do anything wrong. Absolutely not. Now, you know, if we're watching the real camera work from, you know, witnesses on the ground, you start to see the absolute injustices that are being done. And we need to talk about that.
I have just one more question. I'm going to turn it back to Kirk to close this out. So I think a lot of this is probably also deterring people from coming to church. So what actions are churches doing to kind of display that they're a welcoming space, and, you know, regardless of people's immigration status, that it's they will be welcome to come and worship together and they will get the support that they need?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's still an ongoing question. I know, I remember I was at a prayer vigil in Washington, D.C. after the federal takeover of D.C. and heard stories of people who in their church, because ICE knew that there was going to be a Spanish language service, basically had shown up a half hour beforehand and kind of surrounded the church. And so they just had to cancel their Spanish language services because they didn't want to put their congregants in danger. And that doesn't matter whether you're documented or not. You know, you're going to get looked at, right? Like if you're a brown person and you're walking in there and God forbid you're speaking Spanish, they're going to assume things about you that may or may not be true. But, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're documented or undocumented in that time, you're going to get targeted. And so, you know, that church had to cancel those services, which again is that's why we say we're not allowed to exercise our religion. We have lost our freedom of religion if we're having to cancel our services because people are going to be targeted when they go there. The hard part is, how do we answer that, and how do we deal with it? I don't think we have a good answer for that yet. I would say to those pastors, you know, it may be like you have to go to visit your people instead of having them come to the church, hang out in their communities. Maybe it's house church for a little while to keep people safe. And really speaking to the rest of the church, if you're a church that has English services and Spanish services, you better be speaking in your English services about the fact that you had to cancel your Spanish services. You better get people to understand that they have a responsibility to the other people who are part of their church community, but who may not speak the same language that they do. And how do we stand up for that? I don't think we have great answers for that yet. I think these are one of the ways that we as churches are going to have to be creative, and we're going to have to think this through. And I think we are going to have to get out of our buildings and think about how do we come to join the people where they are in need, and be present with them. And not just the pastor, but the people too. How are we doing that? And I think it is the challenge of our time. And maybe in many ways, the challenge that our churches need. I think we've gotten too complacent a lot of times, expecting we're a great church, people will just come to us. And that's not how we spread the good news of liberation and love. We have to go out into the world. And so I hope that part of the side part of this is that churches go, wait a minute, we have to be creative, we have to rethink, and we have to show up in those places where people are being targeted and stand up for them and figure out how to be the church in this moment in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked a lot about what's going on currently, and not to dismiss or be dismissive of what's going on right now, but also trying to look ahead and see what does the future hold regarding the current climate that we're in. I know over 25 years in the United Church of Christ, you've been serving. And of course, now you are a conference minister for Justice and Witness. What encouragement or advice do you have for other faith communities considering becoming a sanctuary church or just justice seeking in general? And what changes either in policy or public attitude would you like to see so that the burden of protecting this vulnerable population, right, our vulnerable neighbors, isn't falling solely on churches? And my last question is, how can everyday people, including our listeners today, get involved in defending the dignity and rights of immigrants in their own communities?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that is, I spoke before about really knowing what the reality of the situation is. I think we have to really work to educate ourselves. You know, sometimes we poo-poo that. We go, oh, it's another book study, or we're another, you know, study on this or study on that. But really, if people have no idea, we have to educate ourselves, right? We have to know, our history before we can know where we're going next. And we have to be able to speak intelligently about it if we're going to actually push back against some of the rhetoric that is happening. And then we also have to know, what are our local laws? Like, how do we keep people safe? And you know, how much things like, once somebody's detained, what are their rights? Do they have rights? You know, if they're undocumented, what are the options for them? If we don't know any of that, or if, you know, what is it going to, how long do they have before they're deported once they get detained or anything like that, then we are at a disadvantage. It becomes very difficult for us to actually be effective. And right now, part of the way in which this has been so successful in many ways by the ICE and people that be is they're just kind of rushing in. They're rushing in and rushing over us and doing a million things at once. And you don't even know where to look. And I think the part of the problem is we get so overwhelmed that we go, I don't know what to do. And we just shut down, right? And It really feels like we're dealing with an onslaught of everything right now. And not all of us are going to be able to become warriors around immigration. So I want to say that too. Like, you can think this is terrible happening with immigration, but maybe in your church, you don't really live in an immigrant community. It's not really affecting you, but there's this other issue that is happening that's affecting your people and the marginalized around you. Don't feel like you have to become a sanctuary church because that's not a working thing for you, but still work for the marginalized in your community, right? In my community, I live in a area that is 50% of the people who live here are foreign born. 50%. I can walk in my neighborhood and hear six languages, just on a walk, because that's just where I live. So in my community, it makes a whole lot of sense for the churches in my community to, if you're caring about your neighbors, to care about immigration and do something about it. But wherever you are, what are the issues that are affecting the people who are marginalized? Do something about that. So, and know what it is and stand up. And I really believe that the only way we are going to make it through this time is to begin to care for each other. I think one of the really hard things about what happened after the pandemic, for a little while during the pandemic, we were like, we are going to love each other and take care of each other. And then we stopped. And we didn't just stop. We went the other way. We're just going to get back to our lives. And so we're going to like just go into our own little silos. And it has allowed things like this to fester. So for me, one of the most important things right now, wherever you are, is getting to know your community, getting to understand what's happening in your community, finding ways that you can be a voice of change in your community for good, whatever issue that might involve. But we have to get out of our houses. We have to get out of our churches. We have to get out of our silos. Get to know our neighbors and make a difference in our communities. That's the only way we're going to get out of this, by just caring for one another, mutual aid, knowing each other's stories and acting on them. And that feels, we want somebody to go, just give us the easy thing we can do that's going to fix this. There isn't one. There isn't one. We have to live through this and push through it. I think it's possible. I think it's the only way through. It's the only way it's ever been the only way through is, people coming together and saying, we are going to stand up for the marginalized together. That's the only way we've ever had change in this country. And I think we need to continue to do that as faith communities and as just as neighbors. It's we cannot hide ourselves away anymore. We have to get to know our neighbors and live that out. And in that way, I feel really good that the main message of my faith is love your neighbor. If we could all just try to love our neighbors a little bit more, whatever your faith beliefs, whatever God you believe in or no God at all, if we could all just try to actually love our neighbors, it would transform the world. It just would. It's so simple, and yet it is the thing we need to do.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for such an insightful conversation. We usually don't talk about religion and theology and bioethics, but this is definitely a pressing issue. And it's definitely related to, of course, poor health outcomes, right? There's nothing healthy when you are stripped from a place of refuge and then, housed in a particular place that doesn't really treat you like a human being, right? So it is a very pertinent issue of our time, a moral issue of our current time. And we're definitely grateful for your insight and your experience in this field. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and I appreciate being able to have this conversation. I think it's part of the ways in which we really push back and make a difference.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.